Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear part two of a three-part presentation entitled Human Misery in Today's World, co-sponsored by the Creighton Department of Theology and the John C. Kenefick Chair in the Humanities. Today's talk will be given by Amy Wendling, Assistant Professor in the Creighton University Department of Philosophy. Her topic will be, Is Suffering Emancipatory? Marxist Reflections on Human Suffering. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 2, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Wendy Wright, a faculty member from the Creighton Department of Theology and the holder of the John C. Kenefick Chair in the Humanities.
Tonight, I am really delighted to be able to introduce Dr. Amy Wendling from the Department of Philosophy. I think she is no stranger to many of you in this audience tonight. Dr. Wendling is one of the most revered, really, professors on campus with a great following among her students. She's just finishing a recent book entitled The Ruling Ideas, which deal with concepts that are important to political life. And her talk tonight will be Is Suffering Emancipatory? Marxist Reflections on Human Suffering. So, Dr. Wendling, thank you very much.
Well, I'd really like to thank Dr. Wright and Dr. Fleming. No one ever asks me about this topic, and I really have a lot to say about it. Karl Marx's work has important, though understudied, implications for understanding human suffering. Tonight, I will explore three of these. One, capitalism promises to end suffering through a rising standard of living, but it does so at a cost by causing suffering to end for some at the expense of others. Insofar as we accept this, it is because we feel economic gain in general to be a suitable explanation for human suffering. But by and large, we do not accept that economic gain for some at the expense of others is a suitable explanation for human suffering. This causes, so this double thing that we accept it and don't accept it, causes a kind of cultural cowardice and disavowal. We want to celebrate capitalism's abilities to conquer scarcity and pain while looking away from the consequences that it incurs while doing so. Two, there is a second cost to late capitalism's rather extreme focus on alleviating even the most minor forms of bodily suffering for some. By doing so, it diminishes attention to other, higher forms of suffering. In many cases, it will even alleviate a minor form of bodily suffering at the cost of exacerbating a cultural suffering of a higher form. I can eat an orange in late January, but I do not know or speak to my neighbors. I can afford a smartphone, but I'm working so hard to do so that I no longer have time to speak on it with my mother. Three, when we regard suffering as a part of what it means to be human, this plays right into capitalism's hands. So long as suffering defines the human condition, capitalism need not acknowledge that at least some forms of suffering are historical artifacts that it creates and exacerbates. When we think of suffering as simply a feature of the human condition, it muddies the distinction between different kinds of suffering. But not all suffering is necessary. Capitalism likes for us to think that all suffering is necessary because we are then less likely to analyze which forms of suffering are unjust. We are also less likely to agitate for the removal of concrete human sufferings, since such sufferings have become pivotal to what our definition of the human is. And four, in conclusion, I will use these three characteristics to meditate on what I think is actually a very hard set of questions. Some of the observations lead us in the direction of the conclusion that suffering is not something that should transparently and in every case simply be alleviated, or at least should not be alleviated without attention to the costs and consequences of this alleviation. While suffering is not unambiguously bad, neither should we see suffering as something simply to be continued, since regarding suffering as part of the human condition acts as an excuse for capitalism and enables and abets the cultural cowardice of looking away from the parts of humanity that especially suffer at capitalism's hands. This latter point is particularly difficult for Christian peoples whose narrative of suffering is too frequently and too swiftly merged with a narrative of redemption or a narrative of liberation. If we can abide for a moment in the discomfort of having these narratives pulled apart, we will be able to ask, what if suffering, both bodily and spiritual, does not always redeem? And we will be able to ask an even harder question than this. What if some forms of suffering not only do not redeem, but hobble and curtail the sufferer's possibilities? What if suffering is not simply senseless, but pernicious and damaging? Okay, so that's the map. And this is section one, the rising standard of living, or why more bodily suffering might be good for some of us. Marx was concerned with the sufferings of a class that he called the proletariat. The proletariat was a class of working people that developed in Europe beginning in 1450 and was fully developed by the 1850s. That's approximate, but it looks so specific as I read it now. Marx observed this class in the London where he made his home in the 1850s. The proletariat was a class roughly analogous to today's working poor. It is important that we don't confuse this class, the proletariat, with what Marx called the lumpen proletariat, an unorganized group of marginal and sometimes also criminal social elements whose relationship to working was intermittent. The proletariat was a developed social class that valued work and sought participation, including political participation, in existing orders. As the Industrial Revolution advanced, members of the proletariat grew more numerous and clustered in industrial centers, especially London. Physical working conditions for the proletariat were deplorable. Marx spends a lot of the historical chapters in his book Capital describing the lack of air for breathing in the proletarian workspace, inadequate nutrition, barely sufficient sleep, and lives that endured only long enough to produce another generation of workers to do the same. In a forthcoming work, I have sought to update our understanding of these sufferings of the working poor. In this work, I discuss inadequate toilet breaks, and I'm working with a lawyer at the University of Iowa on some of his older work about legislation in this country about toilet breaks for the working poor. Repetitive stress injuries and malnutrition, I think, including both starvation and obesity. At the same time as the sufferings of the proletarian class became exacerbated, there was the creation of enormous wealth in Western Europe. Scientific manipulations of nature became the norm. Legal codes became a significant way of negotiating political power. The class who was the main beneficiary of this wealth was known as the bourgeoisie. The physical sufferings of the bourgeoisie were, to be sure, greatly ameliorated as it rose to power as a dominant class, a power that was very secure by the time Marx is writing about the bourgeoisie in London in 1850. The bourgeoisie was itself a revolutionary class, not distinguished by noble birth, though often by the 1850s intermingled with it. Marx was gladdened by the new scientific manipulations of nature that accompanied the ascendancy of the bourgeois social class. He was enthused particularly by the prospects for agricultural fertilizer, in the same ways we are today enthused by the prospects of biofuel or cold fusion technologies. Such technologies seem to push back the boundaries of nature as we have understood it and to allow us to imagine a world free from scarcity and want. But unlike those who simply celebrated the achievements of the bourgeois social class, Marx could not help but notice that these achievements were grounded and caused by the sufferings of the proletariat. It was these sufferings that made such achievements possible, since the proletariat had, over a period of years, made possible the accumulation of wealth that left some members of society free to produce science, law, and other forms of bourgeois knowledge. Marx's main criticism of its structure, this structure is its injustice, that it produces great wealth, leisure, and beauty for the very few at the expense of hobbling, stunting, and torturing the many. Individual economic gain itself is a poor explanation for continuing and exacerbating the sufferings of the proletariat. I think, despite certain appearances to the contrary, and we can talk about them, that everyone agrees about this. And so Marx seeks for a different kind of explanation, and this is the reason why he postulates a proletarian revolution. With the idea of revolution, even Marx points to a kind of redemption as an explanation for why the proletariat must suffer. for its sufferings permit the production of great wealth, and so form the foundation of a future society free from want. But the revolution that Marx postulates as an acceptable explanation for suffering does not arrive in the London of 1850s. If it can be said to arrive at all, it arrives as a bourgeois revolution against existing feudal structures, leading Georges Bataille and others to argue that revolution as a concept is tied to the overcoming of a feudal worldview. In light of this, the revolution that would justify suffering functions only as a false promise. So long as it does not arrive, we are left only with individual economic gain as an explanation for suffering. And yet the false promise hovers around the bourgeois world, and especially the world of the bourgeois apologist. Hasn't the bourgeoisie truly made more wealth available for all? The apologist is thus able to use the unrealized prospect of revolution in order to justify and abet class inequality and individual economic gain. Moreover, the apologist is able to do so even or perhaps especially when class inequality and individual economic gain persist in the face of the continued sufferings of the global proletariat. Life in the most developed countries makes it especially easy to believe in the world of the bourgeois apologist. In the 20th century, movements like Fordism brought consumption objects like cars within the reach of the ordinary workers who were producing them. This happened in part because capitalist luxury markets reached certain limits and had to more thoroughly exploit existing markets in order to continue to expand production. It also happened because capitalism could not continue to exist in developed countries in the extreme, legislatively unregulated forms observed by Marx in the London of 1850. But the palliative of expanding consumerism extends the explanation of individual economic gain so that it becomes possible, even for the working classes, to use it as an excuse. They notice how thin of an excuse it is only when markets plunge into crisis, as they inevitably do, and the palliative is removed. In the 20th century aftermath of Marx's theory, only a few thinkers are bold enough to suggest that instead of continuing to hope for a revolution, we ought to consider cuts to our standard of living rather than continue to live at the expense of the bodily sufferings of the global poor. The most important of these thinkers is Herbert Marcuse, a Jewish transplant from Berlin who lectured in the University of California system, but also worked for the U.S. State Department. All right, so we're to section two, lower and higher forms of suffering, hunger, but also alienation. While meditating about the images that I might use in order to give this talk, I noticed that many of the stock marketing images used to deploy suffering are distinctly bodily images. On television in the United States, we see spectacles of injured and hungry animals, or spectacles of hungry people, usually children, in another country. In response, we are asked to write a check that sends monetary aid. Such aid is inevitably quantified as a very small amount comparatively in the scope of the check writer's vast resources. While I do not wish to minimize the sufferings of hunger and injury, I believe this structure abets our ability to look away from some of the economic structures that produce hunger and injury, and in the following ways. First, I am asked to take responsibility for the hunger and injury only by producing a small amount of money, not by changing my standard of living, lifestyle, or beliefs, or by recognizing that the economic systems on which my great wealth is founded may make all money blood money. The very smallness of the amount illustrates how little such people and animals' health and well-being are worth. And this reassures me of my great comparative economic wealth, making me feel better about myself. Second, and this effect is, I think, still more subtle, I am encouraged by such images to focus on bodily sufferings rather than higher-level moral, spiritual, intellectual, and imaginative sufferings. In this way, my attention is actually constantly refocused on the things that capitalism, in its advanced forms, is good at alleviating. The spectator is unlikely to know hunger or the sufferings of a lack of clean water. He or she has laws to appeal to when violence is inflicted. He or she has access to the medical sciences of basic inoculation and antibiotics. And so there is a psychic payoff for the spectator for the sufferings of others that caters to what is worst in us. He or she feels safe and warm and glad to be so, and that perhaps this is enough. One of Marx's great achievements is that while he never forgot the lower level or bodily sufferings of the proletariat, he was also concerned with its higher level sufferings. The proletariat worked only to live, and to live only in the limited sense of continuing its biological facticity, a situation that Marx called alienation. But alienation was not simply limited to inadequate food and a short lifespan, but encompassed the wounds inflicted on the proletarian intelligence, imagination, and spirit. Marx's classic theory of alienation charts four moments. The proletarian is alienated from the object she creates, from the activity she performs, from the basic entitlements of the human species, and from other human beings. And I'm going to go through these, what these mean. I give this lecture every time I talk, I feel like. The four moments of alienation. I think it's really important. I think it's some of the richest stuff from Marx's corpus. The proletarian is alienated from the object she creates in the sense that others and not her use the object. This model of material deprivation is, of course, also a kind of low-level suffering. But it is also a higher-level suffering, and for the following reason. We all know that the difference in the pleasure that I get from consuming or using an object that I have created is different and higher in quality than the pleasure I get from consuming an object that someone else has created. This is because the pleasure is not the consumption itself, but the back and forth between subject and object, between imagination and the material world that occurs in designing something for oneself. The pain, then, of being separated from the object that one has created is not simply the loss of the object, but the loss of one's design and intentionality in creation. This is closely related to the second moment of alienation, in which the proletarian is alienated from the activity of creation itself. Instead of amplifying his capacities for creation and imagination, his labor becomes boring and monotonous. Since longer hours are spent at this boring and monotonous activity than at any other kind of activity, he becomes alienated and learns to hate and disavow his own activity. He no longer enjoys his labor experience, not simply because it is dangerous or hard, but because it does not actualize his abilities to enjoy it while he is doing it. Against such a backdrop, all labor is a kind of suffering. While these first two forms of alienation have clear lower-level dimensions, they also have higher-level dimensions. The second two forms of alienation are both exclusively higher-level forms of suffering. Marx viewed artistic and scientific activity as to be the basic entitlements of the human species. In the third form of alienation, the proletarian suffers from not participating in art or in science, being neither the beneficiary of artistic and scientific discoveries, nor portrayed as the important subject of artistic and scientific works, nor educated to participate in the process of developing art and scientific insights. Finally, Marx thought that alienation cut human beings off from one another, making us see one another as hostile competitors in a scarce world and allowing for little solidarity among humans. The fourth form of alienation conditions us to reverse the kind of social feeling that John Stuart Mill sketches in his Moral Theory. He writes, "A person in whom social feeling is at all developed cannot bring himself to think of the rest of his fellow creatures as struggling rivals with him for the means of happiness, whom he must desire to see defeated in their object in order that he may succeed in his." The fourth form of alienation, however, works on us until we can only bring ourselves to think of our fellow creatures as struggling rivals with us for the means of happiness, who we must desire to see defeated in their object in order that we may succeed in ours. The fourth form of alienation is thus not the loss of other people as a source of material comfort. Material comfort can be obtained from slaves and subordinates. It is the loss of a feeling of human interaction and of the possibilities for authentic friendship, love, and other forms of social feeling. It is a form of false consciousness that separates us from the others and burdens us with a constant and escalating mistrust. Moreover, Marx argues that it is not only the proletariat that is alienated in these ways, but also the bourgeoisie. In no longer producing objects that they use because others produce these, the bourgeoisie also loses contact with the higher pleasure of consuming or using something that one has made oneself. In no longer laboring, the bourgeoisie also loses contact with a meaningful and balanced experience of human activity. In subordinating the discoveries of art and science to the demands of markets, the bourgeoisie turns them into private property and limits their range of use to those who can afford them, and their range of development to devices and forms that can be easily commoditized. Finally, the bourgeoisie is also in the grip of the fourth form of alienation and also thinks of other humans as competitors in a hostile environment, a way of thinking about other humans that develops its that damages its relationships. However, in order to see the sufferings of alienation not only by the proletariat but also by the bourgeoisie, one has to have a notion of a higher rather than a lower level of suffering. For while the bourgeoisie may never know the sufferings of hunger, he or she is certainly vulnerable to the sufferings of being cut off from other humans or of having inauthentic relationships to them, to the sufferings of being bored, and to the sufferings of being duped by psychological manipulation into the political attitude that individual economic gain is a suitable reward for such sufferings. If all sufferings are understood to be lower-level sufferings and only lower-level sufferings, this allows the bourgeois to escape the truth that he or she is also suffering at the hands of the capitalist system of production, since his or her higher level sufferings become invisible or unimportant to the concept of suffering. Marx's account of alienation develops after this. This four-point alienation is his very early work. In some directions I explored in my first book, where I kind of look at how it is we have come to value machines more highly than people. In my forthcoming work, I look especially at those forms of alienation that burden both the bourgeoisie and the working classes, and especially at temporal domination, so being dominated by abstract time. I argue that temporal domination conditions sufferings as diverse as those inadequate toilet breaks that I mentioned earlier, but also boredom, there's a section on boredom, multitasking, the proliferation of timekeeping devices, the temporal conditioning of the emotional response, like when you're angry in traffic or something's taking 5 minutes too long. And the accompaniment of every thought and task by an eerie sense, fairly precise, of how long that task is taking. From these considerations, it should be clear how making suffering into an ontology of the human experience can play into capitalism's hands. In the last two sections of the talk, we have to recall the meaning of two important philosophical words. The first is ontology. The second is teleology. By ontology, philosophers mean the being of something, the mode in which it exists, or even how something is defined. By teleology, philosophers mean acting purposively in pursuit of a goal or outcome. I'm going to return to teleology in the concluding section, so let me dwell in this one, with the idea of ontology. When we give an ontology of human beings, we offer a series of explanations for the kind of things that humans are, things that are essential to define the definition or core being of the human. Ontologies of the human answer the question, what is it to be human? Or even the question, I cannot imagine a recognizably human life without X. Many different systems of thought offer answers to these kinds of questions. Plato would have said that to be human is to have logos, a complicated Greek concept that means both language and the ability to engage in conceptual thinking, and as I understand it, five or six other things besides this. Aristotle is famous for calling humans the political animal, a phrase in which he gets at both the idea of civic engagement and also the idea of basic human community. Many modern thinkers would have answered these questions by saying, what is the human, or I cannot imagine a recognizably human life without rationality. Right? That would be the key or defining feature. As a feature of their operation, such ontologies often claim to speak for human nature. Nonetheless, the fact that we can give different answers to these questions, and that different answers to these questions become more prominent in different periods of history, that different answers to these questions are given by different peoples, and that different systems of thought highlight or prefer some answers to others seems to suggest that the ontology of the human has an essential historicity. This does not mean that ontologies of the human are not important, since a key feature of being human seems to be being a human historically, and thus participating in those ontologies of the human that have come to prominence. One of the ontologies of the human that capitalism tends to highlight and prefer is the identification of the essence of humanity with labor. What is it to be human? It is to labor. I cannot imagine a human life without labor. Another ontology of the human that capitalism tends to highlight and prefer is suffering. What is to be human? It is to suffer. I cannot imagine a human life without suffering. In hitting upon labor and suffering as answers to these questions, capitalism does not invent anything new. Instead, it revives and rejuvenates older discourses that celebrate these answers, but it revives and rejuvenates them for its own purposes. Marxist thought worries about the identification of humanity with labor and suffering because doing so forms an alibi for capital's exploitation of the working classes and even an alibi for capitalist alienation. If life simply is suffering, why should I expect or agitate for anything better? Let me speak for a moment of how this identification of humanity with suffering labor operates today, and not simply among the working poor, where its consequences are rather obvious, but also among the bourgeoisie. We are very marked by the kind of work we do. In the most intensively capitalized bourgeois environments, one's identity is determined almost exclusively by one's labor. This determination produces a number of sad, practical consequences. There is the role that work plays in one's self-identity, the difficulties of retirement, and an intolerance for what comes to be regarded as the weaknesses of human embodiment. Finally, there is the identification of labor with suffering itself, the most important consequence of which is that we no longer have a strong notion of productive and edifying human activity, a kind of labor that is explicitly not suffering. In casual conversations with strangers in North America, one of the first things often asked is, "What do you do?" This is not a question about one's activities of the day. It is a demand for a labor-based identity card. The questioner is asking what one does for a living, that is, for work. A number of bourgeois assumptions accompany the asking, especially that one supports oneself financially through one's work, and that one identifies with one's work, that one's work is, in a meaningful sense, what and who one is. A number of judgments follow upon the response to this question, especially a conscious or unconscious judgment about the social class or class fraction of the respondent. In this way, the social body constantly reinforces the equation of identity and labor, and especially the equation of identity and wage labor, salaries included. The dysphorias that accompany retirement are an unsurprising corollary of long habituation to such an environment. If the notion of meaningful activity is increasingly foreclosed by the notion of labor, there is nothing to be made of a life not determined by labor. Unsurprising, then, that retirement is accompanied by a host of physical and psychological health problems that cannot be simply or convincingly accounted for by advancing age. Thus, although retirement is spoken of as a desired goal of the bourgeois social class, it is equally dreaded and feared, however vociferously disavowed this dread and fear may be. Oddly, the very financial pressures that delay retirement or disallow it altogether may actually form a kind of shield against these dysphorias, though such pressures, of course, are accompanied by other kinds of problems. In bourgeois cultures, the value accorded to labor causes a disproportionate focus on the young and middle-aged over against those who are older and those who are very young. Rightly or wrongly, it is the young and the middle-aged that are conceptualized by bourgeois cultures as most able to work. This form of age-based cultural priority is evident in everything from media portrayals to distributive patterns. Wealth and material resources are disproportionately allocated to the workforce, and so in bourgeois cultures, we find material poverty among the very old and the very young. The value accorded to labor in bourgeois cultures is also related to these cultures' inability to acknowledge aspects of identity that are received rather than those that are achieved. Many of the peculiar facts of human embodiment, and especially one's own birth, illnesses, death, and needs for food, drink, and rest, are looked upon as flaws, weaknesses, and liabilities. In opposition to this blind spot, philosopher Lee Johnson gives an account of what she calls weak humanism. Johnson means weak humanism in a double sense, both as a humanism of these weaknesses and as a revival of humanistic thought without the liberal trappings of labor-based achieved identities, trappings that have, among other things, led to racist and other terrible exclusions. Finally, there is the association, subtle or overt, between labor and suffering itself. If all labor is a form of suffering, we will tend to distrust those activities that are pleasant or edifying and to feel that we are not laboring at all when we engage in them. Our authentic self will, as a result, only come about as a product of suffering. The association between labor and suffering will thereby haunt human activity insofar as this activity is only conceived as labor, since the inference will be that all human activity is and should be a kind of suffering. In this kind of inverted world, suffering can also drift free of the labor concept and become valued, sought out, and produced, whether adjunct to labor or not, both one's own suffering and that of others. It is well known, perhaps above all by Max Weber, that the ontology of humanity as laboring and suffering plays perfectly into capitalism's hands. Weber loves to blame Protestant Christianity for this, but I think that's not the only place you could locate it. It's just where he does. Loves to do that. The identification of labor and suffering forms an excuse for the continuation and amplification of alienated labor. The bourgeois intellectual synthesis tightens the identification between labor and suffering and then makes miserable labor the ontology of the human self for the purposes and ends of advancing capitalism. But does labor have to connote suffering, either experientially or conceptually? For what if suffering does not liberate? And so we come to section four, the conclusion. What if suffering neither emancipates nor redeems? Marx ends the Communist Manifesto by advising the working people of the world to unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. But 19th century scholar Daniel Conway is quick to add, and your lives. And so not even Marx is immune from reintroducing the basic teleological structure that haunts much of Western thinking, and Conway, I think, is right to call him on it. Recall that by teleology, this is the second fancy word we need to remember, philosophers mean that something that acts purposively in pursuit of a goal or outcome. But when we give suffering a teleology, as we habitually give most things in our thinking, not just suffering, it's just a habit. It's a habit it's a long habit, actually, of our thinking. When we give suffering a teleology, as we habitually give most things in our thinking, this structure biases us from the outset in the direction of interpreting all suffering as emancipatory. At best, Marx, atheist that he was, transposes the emancipation of the heavenly redemption of the suffering poor to the earthly redemption of the suffering poor in the form of revolution. But this transposition does not eliminate the teleological structure through which suffering is interpreted. And I should say as an aside, I think Sartre is right that none of the great 19th century atheists fully wriggle out of the teleological mode of explanation when they eliminate heaven, though Nietzsche and Freud, I think, are more successful than Marx at trying to do so, right? So there's just, teleology stays, it's sort of almost unavoidable in our habits of thought. Even when we think we've gotten rid of it, it's still there. Even if we have the pretension that we've gotten rid of it, it's still there. Marx's retention of giving suffering the teleological explanation of earthly revolution leaves us with at least two uncomfortable problems, both of which have to do with revolution. The first is that this explanation falsifies and reduces the kinds of suffering experienced by the proletariat, and also that it judges earthly revolution as a sufficient explanation through which sufferings are redeemed. I call this the Conway problem. Conway's troubling addition to Marx's call at the end of the manifesto shows that proletarians have more to lose, in fact, much more to lose, than their chains. The second problem is whether in earthly revolution, some are ultimately redeemed and emancipated at the expense of others. If so, the proletariat's sufferings become all the more necessary and might even be exacerbated in order to hasten the more thorough transformation of an imagined future world. But this does not seem comforting. I only read you one long quote, and this is it. As Hans Blumenberg writes in his 1,000-page Legitimacy of the Modern Age, which I have carefully read, And now we'll explain the really good bits to you. The long periods of time required for the tiniest steps of evolution may indeed have made the great waste of nature, its huge expenditure of individual suffering and death, appear in a light of new significance. But as human security, as justification of man's historical status, they are empty of comfort. Man as an individual now had to perceive himself as impotent vis-a-vis time, the omnicompetent. The position of transcendence was reoccupied by the element of, he means, temporal postponement. The lack of temporal congruity between the natural process and the acute historical situation in which man finds himself emerges with extreme sharpness. Marx's socio-political diagnostics of revolution in his late work, Capital, becomes subject to the problem of postponement outlined by Blumenberg. Although political revolution, as we've said, was a tangible reality in the Europe of 1848, revolutions were breaking out all over, it is far less so by the time Capital was published in 1867. Instead, the waiting has begun. In his analysis of the capitalist mode of production, an analysis that reveals the norms of capitalist thinking in addition to the norms of capitalist making, Marx empties his own acute historical situation of the comforts of either immediate revolution or the struggle for better wages. Instead, Marx postulates an inevitable, though temporally deferred, totalizing transformation. For Marx, society rather than nature enforces suffering. The suffering that appears in the works of Adam Smith, Hegel, Malthus, and Darwin is a bourgeois rather than a natural postulate. So Marx thinks he's solved the ontological problem by revealing it to be historical, but he only solves the ontological problem by exacerbating the teleological problem. This view still commits Marx to using suffering as a social mechanism for change. In his postulate of revolutionary transformation, the 19th century amalgamation and analogy between the social and the natural has been reversed, but it has not been left behind. The teleological logic of postponement, so characteristic of 19th century scientific description, the invisible hand at work over large stretches of time, continues to determine the prospects of social and political revolution. This element of postponement not only leaves Marx powerless to address the question of immediate human comfort, but actually obscures this question in the giant units of political time that intervene before such comfort could be realized. Oddly, this means that Marx is intellectually conservative at precisely the moment when he is politically most radical. At this moment, Marx transcribes the teleology that he has inherited from Smith, Hegel, Malthus, and Darwin into Capital's operation and eventual overcoming through earthly revolution. Marx's prediction of crisis is also nature's revenge. In his refusal to ameliorate the immediate human situation, through, for example, the better real wages he argued against in his speeches to men's working associations. Right? He argued, he gave speeches, he said, wages won't help you. Right? They might in some limited way, but that would be giving up the liberation that was to come. Okay, so in his refusal to ameliorate the immediate human situation in favor of the deferred but inevitable political revolution that will end all wage labor, Marx calls on the sufferings of a natural human body at its limits as the driving motor of history. Refusing the claims of labor unions to more material wealth within the capitalist system for fear of pushing back a revolutionary apocalypse, Marx reinstates the structure of suffering and its inevitable operation as well as the invisible hand of economics. In such a view of society, the degree of immediate human control and management of both the natural and the social worlds is once again low rather than high. All we need do is await the inevitable. And in the meantime, we suffer, and such suffering does not appear to be emancipatory. And so what at first appears as the Marxist explanation for suffering is actually not an explanation at all. And I can think of many questions I hope you'll ask, but I'm willing to entertain others. Thank you.
I'm sure there are all sorts of other questions you wish I was going to ask. This is totally random. But I was interested in what you're talking about with respect to the habits of teleological thinking. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if in your opinion that is something that, I mean, I don't know if you can solve this, but is largely historical, or whether that habit is reflects something about the nature of reasoning, such that not that we're always correct in our teleologies, but I mean, you know, some might argue that there's kind of, you know, reason itself as a structure is kind of teleologically geared towards truth, or and if that's so, I was just curious about your reflections on that.
I do think it's a habit in our thinking that becomes more and less pronounced at different periods of intellectual history. And here's the answer to your question sort of from the side way. That's also because a different vision of reason becomes more or less pronounced during different periods of philosophical history. So 18th century reason, the kind that gives us science, is so teleological in its mandates, whereas 17th century reason is a little more flexible, right? So I don't actually think it's that. I think that the terms work together, and you can see a sort of variation in between them. But I think it's a great question.
Thank you very much, Amy. You said that Christian people, the Christian narrative of suffering connects too much to redemption, or something along those lines.
It's the very beginning.
And I wonder if you'd flesh that out a bit more. So I wasn't sure I followed that point.
I am used to, hang on. Well, I think in the sort of central figure of the Christian tradition, namely Christ, I do find the narrative of suffering merged very centrally with that of redemption. And I'm often thinking that sort of, like, my preference for the abstract crucifix probably has something to do with my sort of allergy for bodily suffering, the pronouncement of a bodily suffering as opposed to these kind of spiritual sufferings. And I think, you know, the Christian tradition is very diverse, and I'm not a theologian, right? But I think that in the centrality of that figure, those two things are together. And they're together in my thinking. And because of that, when I pull them apart, I really don't want to see senseless suffering. I really find that difficult, not only for those reasons, but for other reasons. If suffering is in fact going to be senseless, I have to sort of work against some very, I think, strong currents in my thinking that want me to look at it as redemptive in some kind of, you know, minor earthly way. I stop eating so much food in order to not feel too full later, or in some sort of either historically redemptive way like the revolution, or some, there's ultimate, every suffering of a poor person will be sort of redeemed in heaven, right? These are my stories, and they're stories I grew up with, and they're very powerful stories. So I wonder how much the Christian tradition just does that as a part of its character, and what part of the Christian tradition that comes from. Is it the Greek part? Is it, right? What part of the Christian tradition puts those two pieces together so powerfully? Mm. Do you have an answer?
I mean, I think that I guess the first thought I had was about the old thing of the Trinitarian necessity of thinking about God and suffering. In other words, there are some parts of the tradition that would say that, like the book of Job, that, you know, we don't know why we suffer, or we can't look into the whirlwind. And there are parts of that tradition that have not a non-teleological response to it. And that's kind of where you go pastorally when it doesn't make sense. But then also you can go to the second person of the Trinity and look at bodily suffering insofar as that's helpful. But I guess my thought was that a 19th century kind of Nietzschean Marxist view of Christianity would tend to emphasize the second person of the Trinity and kind of downplay some of the more broad Trinitarian strokes of the tradition. But
I mean, what I would say about sort of Marxism and Christianity, and then Marxists taking on Christianity, like later Marxists, Weber's the best example. It's a certain strain of a very rich tradition that we all learn about. But a certain strain, especially, I think, as you're saying, second person focused, and in Weber's case, explicitly Protestant. I mean, you see this much more richly in the Protestant tradition, the focus on work, mm-hmm. right? The focus on labor, the focus on suffering, than you do, or you see it emphasized in those traditions to a greater degree than I think you see in some other parts of the traditions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ross.
I have a couple questions. First, when you're talking about the suffering, it seems to me from your paper, Marx talking about suffering, many focus on body suffering. Mm-hmm. Is there like anything he's talking about, the mental suffering, mm-hmm. such as, well, we don't want to watch, such as when workers work in the very poor condition, their body suffers. How about others, those people who made them suffer? Do they feel mentally suffering? Mm-hmm. Did the markers ever talk about that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what I tried to get at the second section of the talk. I can't now remember. Maybe it's the third. Right, when I said alienation, it is bodily, but it is also that I feel cut off from other people. Right? And he seems especially to think these forms characterize proletarian life. And I think my work has sort of pushed in the direction of showing sort of we all suffer from these higher forms of suffering in a culture where we feel like we're cut off from other people would be centrally one. So I think his discussion of alienation, but here's the deal. He does get pulled back every time to those descriptions of factory workers, and it is their bodily suffering that sort of demands to be discussed. When I don't have enough air to breathe, the wounds to my imagination seem minor, and I understand why he's pulled in the direction of that bodily suffering. While at the same time, I think we could sort of tease out of his account richer discussions of higher level suffering, suffering to the spirit, not feeling you're part of the species, not feeling that you understand art or that you're welcomed into scientific, not benefiting from the scientific discoveries, right? So I think these are all kinds of suffering, but I think there's a kind of back and forth in his work when as he really looks at the condition of the urban proletariat in London, he keeps having this bodily suffering drawn to his attention.
Good, thanks. This is the second one is it seems like from your talk, Marx didn't want to accept the revolution at first place, but he think hard, and at the end, Marx accepts the revolution. He think this is a way probably can cut off suffering. But my question is revolution a way to cut off suffering? It could be. It's a shortcut. Can end the capital, the seeing of capitalism fast. But at the meanwhile, it creates new suffering,
right?
Because it allows one group of people to kill another group of people or do whatever things to other group of people. So is there any criticize on this part?
Yeah, this I think is really striking in his text. It's easy to remember. It's easy to sort of see the revolution as a redemptive structure. Maybe it's my habit of thinking in which one sees. But revolution is a war, which means people are going to die. And one of the ways I try to get it into my work is thinking of actually Marx as a species of just war theory. This is a bizarre, but once you find that groove, it'll fit. You'll find it fits. But that actually means the revolution is really bloody and violent, and people will get hurt on the wayside, and there will be a great deal of suffering to it. So I think pulling away actually that redemptive structure from revolution is one way of seeing it clearly too, and sort of seeing what its ills might be in addition to what it might, how it might liberate or how it might ameliorate conditions in some imagined future. The other thing I see, and this actually gets back to Anne's question, to Dr. Ozar's question, is there are some thinkers who've tried to chart out non-teleological models of revolution. What would revolution mean if it didn't come at the end of some historical process? And I like the Italians, actually. The Italian Marxists, there's something. Marxism varies quite a lot based on sort of country of where it lands, as you may know, right? Yeah. But the Italian Marxists have this idea of sort of revolution springing up alongside every time we are able to think something differently or use our imaginations or do something differently and go in a different direction, therefore sort of taking some of these structures out of it. And also, I mean, in a certain way, taking the violence out of it too. There are others. Okay. I don't know that they're as successful as the Italians. But there are others who sort of tackled the problem.
Yeah, this is a good example. My third question, also is the last one, is when you're talking about alienation, you think it seems to me, based on my understanding of your paper, capitalism creates alienation. So, the evidence is human beings are no longer like a human being, they like right. animals.
Right.
But it so that's why that's bad. But this one probably not directly connected to Marxism. But if we look at the alienation from the perspective of nature, what's wrong? We can be part of a species and equally exist with other animals.
Right. There's a very rich history to this term alienation, and it means a lot of things. I try some of these out in my first book. I mean, there's Rousseau and there's Augustine and there's all kinds of things. And he means by it a rather more specific thing, but I think he actually means to tie it to all these other senses of the term. He's committed, he's part of this tradition that clearly wants to distinguish humans from animals, even though he's a materialist, so it's kind of an odd juncture, right?
Yeah.
But he does think that he celebrates the imagination of sort of all the classic German idealist higher faculties, and he is clear to distinguish us from what bees are doing in terms of our organization. These are just, you know, this is just the historical situation of the figure. So he doesn't have a great answer to your question. Unless, I mean, we could also, I live with dogs, as I know you do, we could also give a richer account of animals instead of giving such, always thinking of animality as some kind of really basic, only being wounded in a small way, right? Tonight I'm giving this lecture and my large yellow Labrador is angry and lonely, right? And it's not simply hungry or tired, he's angry and lonely.
If I can bear with you, I'm wondering on some levels, though, to help me understand if you're and how you're approaching this, is there a fundamental difference between what the person's experience of suffering in capitalism versus a non-capitalist system? I mean, clearly if I get hit by a car and break a leg, I don't care whether it's a Mercedes or a Trabant. Or if I'm the closeness of the ability to get enough air in a Manchester factory or a Greek trireme is probably similar on a psychological level. I was interested in your notions about time and that whole level of suffering, which I am incredibly afflicted with. But the communists suffered with 5-year plans, and you know there is structure. Is this modern? Is this more about modernity than it is about capitalism?
Two things. I was with you more in your first example than with your psychological example, because I do think bodily sufferings in a certain very low-level sense are probably very similar. Very similar. I think I could go that far. However, all the things that overlay them, even our interpretation of what they mean, I think are very different based on kind of our historical conditioning. The simple answer to the second question is, by capitalism, I mean modernity. I mean what happened in the 15th century to the 19th century. So I am using this term, which Marx gave us, which we forget this. He gave that a name. That's his name, right? I mean modernity, and I mean all that comes with it. I mean in a very global sense. I don't mean sort of a limited economic system of production. And I think that most of the things that have called themselves non-capitalists are just versions of capitalism. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell a story that I love to tell. I was in Berlin, I can't remember what year. Was I already here? I might be able to remember what year. I was already here, but I was just here, which makes it about 2006. And I was in the old part of the city in a museum that had exhibits of artworks of things from Stalin's regime and Roosevelt's and FDR's. It was sort of amazingly... From our ideological perspective, this is sort of impossible to hear. But what's amazing, sort of, as you look at each of these three descriptions, they're all celebrating exactly the same thing. Industrialization, right? A certain glorification, even a certain realist style, right? And so I really just, by capitalism, I just mean modernity.
Amy, could you say a little more about the tyranny of time that's so fascinating?
This is good, and there's a whole chapter on it in the new book. One of the things we talk about lots of ways of charting out how to measure social class and experience of social class, and of course there are social scientists who do this in a more empirical way than I do. I have sort of a conceptual explanation. But it occurred to me, instead of thinking about money like wages or also wealth, our relationship to time was a rather profound indicator of our social class or our social class fraction, right? Here's the simple example from the work on the bathroom breaks, the toilet breaks. Am I the kind of person who, when I need to go to the bathroom, can just go, can exit my job and go? Or am I the kind of person who isn't, right? Am I asking permission to do something like that? And then it's a 60-page chapter, so I'm trying to figure out what I want to say, kind of zero it in. So it started from those observations. And then it became a kind of characterization, maybe more generally, explicitly about contemporary experiences of temporality, even kind of cutting across social class. So, you know, standardized time in British towns is kind of new. They had the railway, they kept wrecking it because there was just one track between towns, and they thought, oh, we better get these bells synchronized. That's a silly story, but it's a true one. And that was only about 100 years ago. So this intensive synchronization and colonization of the consciousness by the norms of abstract time, such that I kind of know what 5 minutes is with accuracy. I kind of know when a task is taking too long. I kind of know when it's not. Is really historically unprecedented and new experience of duration, right? And it comes to bear very violently as a kind of strategy of manipulation if you are, let's say, in a certain kind of job, right? It can be a way of manipulating you. But I think for all of us, it has certainly become socially normative. So I move from those observations about it being designating your class fraction to it being just a system of kind of domination and control, and an amazingly effective one, right? If an amazingly effective one. And there's a section not only about clocks, you know, for a while you had a wristwatch, and those were a little still idiosyncratic, like mine might be a few minutes off yours, and now we have all these GMT devices that precisely organize us in kind of coercive ways into brackets and experiences of duration. And then there's the kind of omnipresence of these devices. It's really hard to get away from an environment where you know not just about what time it is, like, oh, I'm kind of hungry, it must be evening, but oh no, it is 7:02. And if I don't stop talking, these people are going to fall asleep. That kind of consciousness about time. Thank you for asking.
Well, thank you so much. Please join me in thanking Dr. Wendling.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the second of a three-part presentation entitled Human Misery in Today's World, co-sponsored by the Creighton Department of Theology and the John C. Kenefick Chair in the Humanities. Today's talk was given by Amy Wendling, Assistant Professor in the Creighton University Department of Philosophy. Her topic was, Is Suffering Emancipatory? Marxist Reflections on Human Suffering. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 2nd, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next program in this special series of talks on human misery in today's world can be heard next Monday, August 20th at 12 noon. At that time, the speaker will be Nikolai Roddy, Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies in the Creighton Department of Theology. His topic will be Ego as Exile, an Older Testament Perspective on Human Suffering. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.